The Black Experience, a program dealing with black history, culture, and literature. This program is produced by the Dallas Public Library and is presented by this station in the public interest.
Good morning. Welcome to the Dallas Public Library's Black History Show. I'm Gail Tomlinson. Today our show is the result of the efforts of many people. We'll be talking about early Dallas black civil rights struggles and history, as seen through the eyes of one of Dallas's most prominent black citizens, A. Maceo Smith. Mr. Smith recently died, but he left a legacy for the black people of Dallas that will live for a long time to come. He was actively involved in the events that changed the lives of every member of Dallas's black community. We owe special thanks to Dorothy Irwin and Julia Scott Reed of the Dallas Morning News, who interviewed Smith before he died about his memories of early-day civil rights struggles in Dallas, and then donated this rich oral history to the Dallas Public Library. We owe special thanks to the staff of KLIF and KKDA, especially to their news director, Mike Snyder, who did all that he could to make this taped history an understandable one. A Texarkana native, A. Maceo Smith, left the South and went north as a youth. After graduating from Fisk University, he took a master's degree in business administration at New York University, and he got into business there by organizing a small newspaper. He came home to Texarkana for his father's funeral. He was only going to stay 3 weeks, but he stayed for the rest of his life in the South. The situation in the South for black people so angered him that he said he pulled off his New York clothes and just got busy. It was the beginning of a missionary spirit against prejudice and restrictions of blacks that lasted the rest of A. Maceo Smith's life. Most of his story will be told today by A. Maceo Smith himself and by Dorothy Irwin, who you will sometimes hear interviewing him and asking questions. The story begins with Smith telling how he came to Dallas, made his contacts in the black community, and set about forming the Negro Chamber of Commerce and other leagues to champion black rights in Dallas.
I moved into the South. Using the National Negro Business League, I began to organize leagues. Texarkana organized the Texarkana Negro Business League, and we did some work there. And then from Texarkana, I went to Oklahoma as a general agent for the Universal Life Insurance Company, revived the Oklahoma Negro Business League, and then did some work on City Front. And then in 1932, E.J. Crawford, the undertaker and businessman from Dallas, came to Oklahoma City. They introduced the Knights of Liberty Fraternal Insurance Company, and I talked with them, and we entered into
negotiations.
Where
was he from?
Dallas.
From Dallas.
So that I entered into negotiation with him, and then we, under an arrangement, come to Dallas. Mm-hmm. I came to Dallas January 1st, 1933.
Well, had he guaranteed you a job?
Yeah.
As a salesman?
Well, he had a little barrel association, and that was to run that and to organize an insurance company. So that he came in and took over that little barrel association called the Lone Star Barrel Association, and then organized the Western Mutual Life Insurance Company. That was in 34.
When Smith came to Dallas, Jim Crow and strict segregation were the rule. For example, blacks were not permitted in the state fair. They had to travel on special railroad cars, and often they had no place to sleep at all on a train. They could not use dressing rooms in Dallas stores to try on clothes. A. Maceo Smith knew that hope lay in organizing blacks, and he set about making the contacts in Dallas that he knew he would need.
I had Albion Holsey, the secretary to the National Negro Business League, and was a confidant of Booker T. Washington, a good friend of mine. He wrote, I had him to write letters to key people in Dallas, tell that I would be coming and about them. A letter went to Dr. R.T. Hamilton, who's an old citizen here, Red Peter. And one went to Ben Kreitz, the general manager of the Dallas Chamber of Commerce. So that I at least had these connections when I got here, and these people were looking for me. Well, 2 weeks after I got here, I had me a group together. I found that they formerly had a Negro Chamber of Commerce, which was organized in 1926, when it died. So I got some remnants of it, and we revived it. I think the first president we had after I got here was Crawford, and then Dr. Hamilton, Dr. Flowers, and Dr. Kingston, and people like that, that we pulled this thing together.
Why did you think that organization was needed here?
You had very little, no articulation of blacks with the ongoing of the city. I mean, it was, you had your little thing on this side of town and white folks on the other side of town, and the twin didn't meet.
Just weren't involved in business activity on any large
scale. Smith decided that a good way to get blacks into the state fair might be to have an exhibit about black history inside the fairgrounds. Texas was preparing itself in 1934 for its 100th anniversary celebration, which would be held in 1936. Smith gathered his friends, J.L. Blunt of Houston, who had made some photographs and knew some history about blacks in Texas, and J. Mason Brewer, a high school teacher who had some knowledge of black legislators. They took their pictures and their proposal to Austin to seek funding from the state legislature. They went before the chairman of the Joint Legislative Committee in Austin to ask for $100,000.
So we got him to an appointment, you know, and we went to Austin and presented these pictures and Negroes in Texas history and so on. When we opened up, the chairman said to me, "I can't give you but 20 minutes. I said, "Well, thank you very much." But I really talked about the Negroes, history, man, all this stuff, and I talked for 45 minutes. I said, "Sir, I'm sorry. Either go on or go to bed. You got only one to get a reason why it should be a celebration." Well, make a long story short, very warmly received.
While the legislature was in session, the governor appointed Sarah T. Hughes to the 14th District Court judgeship, and that created a vacancy in her place in the legislature, which had to be filled by a general election in Dallas. Any citizen could file, and 65 people did, including one black candidate, Judge Amon S. Wells. Smith's support of this black candidate cost him his state money for his project, and it gave him some insight into how Dallas politics sometimes worked.
Well, this is at the same time that we were trying to get this money to set up Negro participation, and they, so some of the key leaders whose names I'd rather not, for history's sake, came, called us in and said, "Now, you boys want your Negro participation, guys. Why have you pulled this black out of the race? You see, why you get your money?" Well, the two key campaign managers of Wells' program was the Reverend Leonard H. Jackson and myself. So we declined and went ahead and pursued our efforts. And Donna Wester was active with us in this whole front as a newspaper.
Let me interrupt you just one moment. When you said the key leaders who came to you with this offer,
Whites.
Did you mean the key leaders in the legislature
Dallas.
Whites.
All right. Came to
us and said
that this would stir race hatred and all that.
I see. Okay.
And only had no blacks, and I could use some other names that they said. In the legislature, you know. They tried to get us first on money and then flatten us on the other way where we stood for them and said no. Well, we
how much money were you asking for?
$100,000.
Okay. Go ahead.
So Wells came in fifth in the race, nationally lost, and we lost our Texas money for Centennial. Well, Well, while we were pursuing this thing, we made friends with some key people that were part of the centennial celebration planning. And there was a man named Klein from Wichita Falls, who was introduced to our committee by Professor Holland of Wichita Falls. This was his great white father there. We went to Wichita Falls, sat with him. He was on the committee to lobby the Congress for an appropriation for Texas. He succeeded in that, and then also convinced John Nance Garner, who was the vice president at that time, that here was a good project for blacks in Texas. Well, now through that contact, we were able to get $100,000.
Later, the general manager of the exhibit hired Smith. But first, Smith had to get his $100,000 from other sources, since the politics that he had played had certainly not won the favor of the state legislature. As a result, Smith decided that the best thing he could do would be to get money for his Black History exhibit from federal sources, and that's exactly what he did. He managed to persuade people in the federal government that this was a good project for blacks in Texas. As a result, he was hired as the assistant manager of the exhibit. He used $50,000 of the money to assemble the exhibit. The rest of the money was used to hire people and set up the exhibit. The big day of the opening finally came. Smith recalls.
Now, at this celebration, which opened on the 19th of June, which in Texas was Juneteenth, the Negro Celebration Day in 1936. Mm-hmm. And of course, we had quite a gala affair and promoted the first interracial track meet that was ever held in the South. And one of, what's my guy out of Chicago, now he's a member of the Congress, Mary DePemmler, Metcalf, Ralph Metcalf, and some others, came in. We brought these white boys that were track stars, and we put on this.
In high school.
Well, this was, these guys were, I think, left in college at that time, you see. He's at Marquette, yeah, he was in college.
Did Texas white people take part?
Yeah, we had some Texas, the University of Texas and some of the others, and we had, it worked out well back then, even in 36. Well, I don't remember. All I know is we put it on and had
it.
Now, during this celebration, in order to bring people to the fair, about four things were much concerned that we did. First, you had to come in here, you had to be on a Jim Crow car, you see. Well, now, people coming out of the north and east, you know, that were in influence, were going. And so we got the railroads to put on what's called a lower 13 travel. You could get a lower berth. For this, I mean, you get a drawing room for the price for lower berth. And this was called berth 13, you see. Now, we brought those people in here, including the committee. It's a very famous committee here that we have. Fred Patterson, Johnny Wilkinson, Bousfield, Zeta Alexander, Rob Van, and those people, and so on. We brought famous orchestras in here. Gap Calloway put on a show. And this was how we attracted people. So this is one thing, as far as the railroads were concerned, that we were able to carry this thing on. The next thing, how to get people here, we formed organization. The Texas NAACP was formed to try to bring into the fair, the centennial celebration, these groups, and we organized the Texas Conference of Branches out there in the Hall of Negro Life, you see, on that front. Meanwhile, we'd already had the Negro Chamber of Commerce that had sponsored getting us into this thing, so we spread that throughout the state and formed the Texas Negro Chamber of Commerce. Then we laid the nucleus for some political action and formed the Progressive Voters League, largely to bring people into the fair. And then, of course, my fraternity had at convention So these are some of the things that went through on the centennial. Now,
why did you think it was so important that there be Negro participation in the centennial? Why was it worth all of this effort to you people?
Well, this, I think it would pay to read this story, because there was some felt that it was another Jim Crow thing, you know. But those of us that sponsored this felt that that participation, you see, you got to start somewhere. You can't start on an integrated pattern. Start and then integrate. Well, this was the way we started this out. Now, we had problems, even with the fad, as you find when you read the story. I mean, there were exhibits out there that you couldn't get in if you black. The toilets we had problems with. And yet, here was a federal exhibit inside where we used the power of the federal government in order to open up a number of those activities in there.
Did you have integrated audiences at any of these events?
Oh, yeah.
You did that.
So, well, I can remember when we would have a special day out there, that escapades would close up because they didn't want the blacks seeing a little naked black guys. I mean, this sort of thing.
After the centennial.
This was during the centennial. We had all of this that we used to open up the thing, so it had its effect on the thing. Now, that's some that, as you read his article, the black newspaper, some of them, said that is another segregated enterprise that you're creating. Why not the fair? Well, it's the fair wasn't going to open up the centennial, so that you had to have some way to get in there on that whole front.
Was there very much press coverage of these events as they happened?
We had considerable press coverage and the
white press.
Yeah, you see, but in some respects it was the usual Southern reaction to Negro celebration. For instance, at the Juneteenth celebration, they're talking about Negro and watermelons.
Mm-hmm.
And this is eating watermelons and so on. Well, I mean, a lot of white people eat watermelons too, but I mean, they get pictures, they did find little Negro and they put on that, picking and eats watermelons. I mean, the Dallas News had lots of stories on that. And you might get through this and find the actual stories that the Dallas News printed at that time.
Was it treated as a serious event in any way in the media coverage, either the black or the white? I mean, did they see this as a political act?
You're
involving, for instance, the federal government funds in it and all that. Was that considered political? Important in any way?
No. This was, since we had to get the money from outside rather than from Texas, Texas failed to play up the fact that we had a federal grant there, you know. But we used it, you know, to broaden the base of operation in spite of Texas' failure.
Do you think the exhibit itself was educational?
Oh, my guess. We had, I guess, near a million people went through there, whites and blacks. And you saw we had all types of achievements of blacks. Dr. Carver came to the exhibit, and great leaders came. You see, and talk to people and move through practice.
That wasn't available to Dallas black people from any other source at that time, was it?
No.
But A. Maceo Smith did not stop with just getting blacks into the centennial. His next big effort involved making black power felt at the polls. He set about registering black voters and enlisted the support of many in the black community to help him. The result of the Pay Your Poll Tax and Vote campaign was simply that one-fifth of the total registered voters in Dallas were black. It was an off-year election, and many whites had not paid their poll tax. Suddenly, the eight candidates running for city council were faced with the reality that the black vote, for the first time in the city's history, would decide the outcome of the election. And A. Maceo Smith was ready to take advantage of the situation to promote what he wanted for blacks in Dallas.
Now, getting back to the politics, in 1937, it was a city election, and the politicians that essayed to represent the black community used whatever side that won, you see, that they would move over through these politicians, and then the politicians would pay on both sides, so that whoever won, they'd have the sheriff, well, they'd have first the chief of police, you know, and then the sheriff, they'd make a deal with. And then they keep dives open in the community, and that was the payoff, you know. So there's no organized political program for the benefit of the people. So this minister that Reverend Maynard H. Jackson, who was a pastor of New Hope Baptist Church, and it was a family pastor that ran for some 50 years. Past the church now is H. Red James out on South Central, but that's the church. He became chairman of the Civic Committee of the Ministers Alliance, and then we went out on the campaign to get blacks to pay their poll taxes.
How much was the poll tax then?
$1.75. Yeah. So we ended up January the 31st, I believe, 37, with 5,000 blacks, which the Dallas Journal, now this was a Dallas News evening paper, published the fact that there were 5,000 blacks registered. Well, this created quite a bit of excitement because the total voting strength now in Dallas was about 30 or 35,000, 5,000 of them blacks, and he were pretty well was a product of how getting these blacks registered.
So this was a significant increase in numbers. Right.
Plus, by being off your election, white people didn't pay the poll tax. You know, well, if you got 5,000 and then you got 6 or 8 tickets running for the council election, you know, well, you got something. Well, now the Citizens Charter Association had been winning every election, you see. But we had them, see, we had a little office up in the Crawford Building right next month. Well, all the candidates and their tickets paid us a visit, you know, including the Charter Association, you know. Now, they may not admit this, because they ain't never been walking up them stairs up in that building. They brought all the candidates up there, you know, with their manager. And we set a day for the interview of these, and we had a 5-point program that we were concerned about. And so little money as we had, we were able to finance our own little campaign, you know.
The 5-point platform that Smith was talking about may not seem that controversial today, but at the time, it was earth-shattering. There was a plea for Negro policemen, public housing, a recreation center run by blacks, a new high school for blacks, and increased employment in city government. These were the things that A. Maceo Smith and others in the black community were fighting for.
Our platform was, as I said, a 5-point deal. First was Negro police, you see.
Did you ask for a certain number, or just...
You couldn't...
At that time, there were none.
None, and the privilege of being a policeman.
All right.
You see? The next was a public housing program. This is in 37 now, mind you, right after the Congress had passed the law of public housing. We wanted a recreational center run by blacks. We wanted a new high school. We had only one. And blacks were moving all over the town and they'd have to come in and so on, all this kind of thing. And we wanted increased employment in city government. Then the five, we said, now, gentlemen, what's your position on these? That's either yes or no on it. We have no other program. Each of those tickets endorsed that total program.
The total program may not seem controversial, but it was exactly what was needed to get the things that blacks wanted at that time. And the Dallas politician faced for the first time that they were going to have to give in, and they were going to have to provide some things for the black community if they expected the black vote at the polls.
We won 5 seats out of that 9, you see. And the mayor was Daddy Sprague, whose son is now the dean of the medical school, Southwest Medical School. The whole 5-point program was carried out during that administration. Lincoln High School was a product of this. This is when the city and the school board were then one outfit, and so on. They voted the taxes and what have you. Right. So with Lincoln, we even did the location of the school. We had some people go out and get some plans on the whole building, Lincoln High School. The recreation center is Wahoo Lake, and the first black to head up a center, we got the name of F.C.A. Lyros. L-Y-A-R-E-L-S, Lyros. He has a daughter that's teaching here now, he's dead. The housing deal, we sent our, well, I believe the city councilman that led that movement was a councilman named Korenblatt, a Jewish fellow. And, we're able to go to Washington with him and present our case before the United States Housing Authority. The employment increased 300-400%. Of course,
the jobs
were elevators and the usual jobs and then common labor and whatnot, but
did
not
you have
many
any
professional
people to
jobs.
Put forward for other types of jobs on a higher level? Were there any people who were able to apply at that time?
Well, at that time, in Dallas, and I imagine many southern cities, there were just certain jobs that Negroes were permitted to get, you know.
They weren't desk jobs.
There were white folks' jobs, and there were black folks' jobs. You know, desk jobs, white folks' jobs.
From the voting that time, in that election, was it clear whether or not these votes were the deciding factor in that election? Did you know for a fact that you would help those people win?
Obviously.
They wouldn't have won without. Could you tell whether black people voted solidly that time?
Mm-hmm.
They did. For this slate.
Oh, man's great. No. Meaning that council knew that without our vote, the 5 wouldn't have been there.
Mm-hmm.
Therefore, our program had to be, you know, and since they control the council.
The program was an important beginning for blacks in Dallas. You'll be hearing more from our tapes of A. Maceo Smith in future programs. It's only one of several programs we hope to be presenting about how blacks in Dallas won civil rights one by one. And future shows will discuss the history of desegregation in Dallas. One thing that is apparent from this tape is how important oral history is. If A. Maceo Smith had not taken the time to sit down and tell his memories of early Dallas, we would indeed be much poorer. If you would like to contribute to the Dallas Public Library's oral history program, contact the Lakewood Branch Library if you lived in the Lakewood area or have interesting memories of that part of Dallas. Or contact the History Division of the Downtown Central Library. Help us preserve this important segment of black history in Dallas.
You have been listening to The Black Experience, a program dealing with black history, culture, and literature. This program is produced by the Dallas Public Library and is presented by this station in the public interest.